Blog Talk Radio.
Historic Blog. Happy Saturday, everybody. We'd like to welcome you to this edition. I think we're on our 30th broadcast, 30 weeks in a row of Blog Talks Radio on Point. We're proud to be a collaborator with the Minnesota Progressive Talkers Network here on Blog Talk Radio. My co-host, Mr. Edwards, hey, how are you doing today?
Fine, Mr. Allen. On this very, very snowy day for our international and domestic listeners, a big snowstorm up here in the Twin Cities. Roads were in pretty bad condition, if you will, but of course we're in Minnesota. We are quote-unquote Minnesotans. We'll quote-unquote survive. Looks like we've got a full menu today, Mr. Allen, as I understand it. One of the things I'd like to do very quickly as it pertains to the domestic scene, and we'll probably be talking a little bit more about this over the coming weeks, the United States House of Representatives censures 20-term Congressman Charles Rangel, Democrat New York, specifically Democrat Harlem. He was required to stand in the well. We watched the entire proceedings, if you will, a very emotional set of circumstances. What kind of surprised us very quickly on that was the number of Democrats that voted to censure. By the way, censure is the second most fatal step in being reprimanded, quote-unquote, or punished by your fellow colleagues. Of course, the most severe is expulsion, which it actually happened to the man that Charlie Rangel succeeded, if you will, 40 years ago, the beloved Adam Clayton Powell. But I thought that Mr. Rangel, Representative Rangel, he continues to hold his seat, carried himself with dignity and et cetera. And by the way, we tend to want to forget that Mr. Rangel was a hero, decorated hero of the Korean conflict, wounded in the area of the Chosun Reservoir in northern North Korea, and was the recipient of the Bronze Star. But that didn't carry any weight. no one wanted to talk about the issue of race. I think maybe later on in today's program we'll certainly do that. Also, Mr. Allen, understand I'd be in and working on a story that's developed in the last 48 hours, the possibility of a administrative change at the Urban League of Minneapolis. Can you kind of detail for us what's happening there?
Yes, Mr. Edwards. I've received several calls from insiders and pretty reliable sources that say that there is a change of leadership getting ready to take place at the Minneapolis Urban League, and that Urban League president, Mr. Scott Gray, was on his way out. And this is something that, you know, we here at On Point and IBN have been covering for a long time, kind of watching him, because when he did come in 2009 there, and today, if you look at his license plates, he's never changed the Minnesota license plates, and we understand through our research, through the National Research Institute, that he's not sold his house in Madison, and he goes there quite a bit, so he was not a mainstay, but sources tell us that they are actively looking for a replacement. And also, I've been putting a call myself to the Minneapolis Urban League to get a comment or editorial piece on what's going on. And they asked me to call the National Urban League, which I did on Friday afternoon. I did follow up. I called and actually talked to a receptionist and left messages for Mr. Herman Lessard, the affiliate manager for the National Urban Leagues all across the country, and Maria Frances, who is Mark Morial's assistant
administrative assistant. Didn't you?
Yeah. And you know, the norm is, Mr. Edwards, because you have tried to contact them directly, too, and they normally do not return calls, but they are quick to come in town and do a paperless audit on the organization and then leave. So no one, you know, ever, there's no documented facts about anything anywhere. So,
yeah. Well, it's absolutely on point, Mr. Allen, because the Rondax Communication Group, Rondax Media Group, of the appropriate professional name, has some stringers in New York following the lead of IBNN, our stringers attempted to contact the National. We thought maybe there would still be someone in the office on a late afternoon. The Rondax Media Group has not been able to find any persons at the Urban League that would talk to this. But, you know, it makes sense that you were referred to the National because in matters of changing at the administrative level called the Office of the President, which is the chief administrator, those things are handled because of the affiliation agreement, if you will, and also an agreement with the United Way of in this case, the Twin Cities or the Metropolitan. The National will handle all matters pertaining to the selection of a new titulate head, administrative head. And so, you know, that kind of makes sense. And, you know, hopefully we'll have a little bit more by next week. But, you know, we've been hearing some troubling things about the Urban League. A lot more litigation going on than we're being told about as the general public. And, of course, you know how that makes me feel as a person who was a longtime participant, chief executive, if you will, as chairman of the board, and et cetera. And, you know, it makes me feel very sad with respect to what's happened. We've already lost the St. Paul Urban League, who went under. Minnesota spokesman Recorder broke that story in July of 2009. People wanted to say it wasn't true, and then the United Way not only confirmed it, but you remember said that the St. Paul Urban League, in fact, had been on probation for 6 years, Don. You know what I'm saying? But I know there have been some additional rumblings ever since Clarence Hightower, the then administrative head, departed under a questionable cloud to become the chief administrator for the local CAP group in Washington and Ramsey County. So, but maybe we'll get some kind of call. Someone will touch base with us, give us some kind of clarity on this. But it looks like we're looking at the possibility of a significant leadership change at the league.
Yeah, and Mr. Edwards, you're being kind of humble, but I would like our international and domestic listeners to understand who you are, okay? Mr. Edwards is the longest-seated chair of the flagship black social service organization here in Minneapolis, the Urban League. He left a few years back. It hasn't been the same. He's been on federal task force to investigate anything from police to civil rights violations. And when the local mainstream newspapers want to call someone in the community to get a comment, an educated comment, they don't call anybody at the University of Minnesota. They don't call anybody at the state capitol. They call Mr. Edwards. So the stuff that we say here on the air is based in sound fact, knowledge, and actually documentation that, you know, I have learned by working with Mr. Edwards over the years too, that you have to have. So,
appreciate it, Mr. Allen. Thank you.
Well,
appreciate it.
I want him to know, Mr. Edwards. But with that said, our calling number is 1-877-572-4288. Again, that's 1-877-572-4288. And anything else you want to get to there, Mr. Edwards?
Back to the local scene. I understand we will have to today talk. I have to, in the sense of how embarrassing it is for a so-called local group that pretends to provide assistance to the community on economic issues. I understand earlier this morning you were told that you could not be in a meeting with an assistant secretary of the Department of Federal Transportation and the group known as NEDA, if their full name, asked you to leave the ballroom at the Meridian Hotel, indicating that you were persona non grata.
Yeah,
I got to tell you, I'm a little shocked by that.
Well, I want to tell you the turn of events. 3 weeks ago, the National Association of Minority Contractors had called me, and they said, Don, you know, we know that you do press releases for your corporate company. You distribute news across the country. We have the U.S. Director of Civil Rights coming into Minneapolis here on the 4th. Can you get some information out? I said, I would love to do that for you. And they said, well, we don't have a huge budget, but we'd give you a table at the event and, you know, bring your wife, your whoever else, you know, come on down and hang out. So I thought that was really great. So
okay,
part of this, Mr. Edwards, was that they said I could come and interview, and I was invited to this luncheon today. And just real quick here, when I walked in, I was saying hello. You had Juana Kirkpatrick there from Met Council. You had Mary Prescott from MnDOT. You had a variety of white contractors there and a couple of board members from the National Association of Minority Contractors. And these are board members that I question on their process with the NAMC. But to say that the worst of it was that Tim Kennedy, who works for the Minneapolis Economic Development Association, came up to me, and if anybody wants to read this, I actually recorded it. He didn't see me recording it, so I couldn't really use that. But if you go to IBNN News, I wrote out the conversation from the recording. He walked up to me, and he said, "Hey, you know this is a private meeting." And I then in return said, "I was invited by the NAMC president." Then he said, "No, Camille," speaking of Camille Hauser, the U.S. Department of Transportation's Undersecretary of Civil Rights, he said, "No, Camille wants to talk to the big boys, and I want her to feel secure." And I asked him, "What are you saying?" He says, "You have to go." And I said, "Well, what about the Minnesota open meeting law?" He said, "That doesn't apply here. This was put on by private funds, and I probably know more about that than you," is what he said to me, as a white boy talking down to a black man. So I just, rather than get to the point where, you want to verbally abuse somebody or have the police called on you, I said, okay, I'm going to disappear from the scene. Because over in the corner, Ms. Hauser was observing this whole conversation.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sure she saw that as a civil rights person. This is a direct violation of quite a few civil rights type issues here and procedural issues, that if they want to talk to the big boys, and I'm looking around in the room and all the big boys there are white contractors, again, we have a huge problem in Minnesota with racism and bigotry as it pertains to contracts and contractors, or minority ethnic contractors and contracts. So,
let me just say, I fully concur and agree. I do disagree with you with respect to the recording and capturing of the comments by the representative of media. As one who's been involved in the litigation issues for a long time, you were in a public facility, irrespective of trying to declare the room to be a closed private meeting, where, by the way, the issue of federal dollars were being discussed. Mr. Lenny Chisholm, if I'm not mistaken, has been one who has done an excellent job. Mr. Larry Tucker is another one. These are gentlemen that I well remember and respect. When you're talking about federal dollars, distribution of federal monies, you can't, quote-unquote, have a private session.
Exactly.
There's no such thing as a private session. Also, what Mita has implied, right after I talked to you earlier this morning and was told that both of us had been told, and you had basically been told to convey to your associate, Mr. Edwards, don't bother to show up or there will be a police action. Of course, in this town, police shoot and kill black folk on a frequent basis, so you have to be careful. But I contacted the National Research Institute and asked them to do some research on the legal provisions of the statement made by Mita. And those statements are totally incorrect, and I'm going to suggest that we, on Monday, file a formal complaint with the Inspector General of the Federal Department of Transportation in Washington, D.C., with respect to what has happened, because really what Mita did was compromise the legal requirements that are imposed upon the Department of Federal Transportation. And also, I'm not so sure that we should not file an administrative complaint with the Department of Justice. It was quite clear that a couple of black journalists were being identified by this white boy to be declared persona non grata. I just think that, and the National Research Institute's legal research department has confirmed this, a serious legal violation took place.
Yeah, I agree 100%. So we're just, tonight they're having their gala. I am going to that. I have tickets, and you'll be there with us, maybe too, also, Mr. Edwards. And I just want to see his demeanor tonight, not to get in his face or anything, but, he knows he was out of line. He was definitely out of line. But, I was going to argue the point with him in that particular setting because, you can live another day. you know, to fight another day. So.
Oh, absolutely. And also what he has done is that he has implied that there is a different discussion piece that takes place when a federal official is in an open meeting and slash a closed meeting. And I don't know that the undersecretary or assistant secretary would have been appreciate the implications of that kind of statement. But I know that by filing a formal complaint with the inspector general, that we will certainly find out how comfortable people were with respect to what happened this morning at the Millennium Hotel in downtown Minneapolis, where a white representative of the group known as Media barred the black media, the black general press, from being in a meeting in which they were discussing issues, by the way, that pertains to stories that we've been doing. And I'm not so sure that in the case of his comments to you personally, Mr. Allen, this is not an outgrowth of information contained in the disparity report, which has become a very controversial document here in the Twin Cities. At page 127 and 126 of the disparities report, there are some very interesting statements, which in fact raise serious questions about the competency and the integrity of MEDA as it pertains to the disparity problem, particularly with respect to businesses and et cetera. And if I'm not mistaken, that is the mandate, that's the mission statement of MEDA, is to improve the quality, if you will, of economic positioning of organizations and agencies of color. Pages 126, 127, the disparities report raises some serious questions about MEDA.
Yes, exactly. And you know, for a long time there, you know, I worked right next door to MEDA and downtown. And for a long time there, you could see that what was going on was a plethora of them getting contracts and guided funding going their way, because they used to say, hey, come on in, businesses. We're going to help you, you know, small minority businesses. We're going to help you achieve success, et cetera, et cetera. And
right.
Then they got to the point where they start charging for that.
Yes.
And
yes.
And then you saw, like you said, there was a huge decline in minority businesses, you know, especially in the black sector. And so.
And particularly in the black sector. And again, we would call attention to the disparities report, that dealing with business ownership, business development, business startup, and et cetera. The numbers for African Americans, Native Americans, in that order are deplorable. In fact, in many categories, it's zero as it pertains to the formation. In fact, that's a word used in the disparity study, the formation of businesses of color, African American, Native American, Hispanic, Asian, and et cetera. You know, there's been some rumor for quite some time that some officials of MEDA have possibly been involved in aiding and abetting the disparity, if you will, that has taken place, and that there may have to be some explanation for the amount of dollars that maybe have been passed back into private accounts. Again, want to get that number out, and you know, we're trying to see if there's anybody that wants to kind of call us about this Urban League situation. I know, as a person who served for 17 years on the board and over 11 years as president, I'm just disheartened. But I just continue to hear some terrible things that are happening over there. I know that's the reason that some of the quote unquote board members of record have bailed out, if you will. No one is talking about that. So,
yeah.
But our number again for both our domestic and international, Mr. Allen,
is 1-877-572-4288. Again, that number is 1-877-572-4288. And we are broadcasting live downtown Minneapolis in the McIntosh Studios here on Point. Now, today, Mr. Edwards, we have a special guest. One of the promos that I did for the this show coming up on the Minnesota Progressive Talkers Network on IBNN, and also a national press release that went out across the country that seem to do very well. We talked about we have someone from the Urban League that wants to, a former employee that has actually called in and wants to discuss some items. And I would like to introduce everybody to Phyllis. Phyllis, are you there?
I'm here. Good afternoon.
Hey, welcome. Welcome to On Point.
Good afternoon, Phyllis. Okay.
Good afternoon.
Okay, we've been touching on some subjects here about the Minneapolis Urban League, and I think we've held the lead here on Point in our respective blogs about some of the disparities that have been happening at the flagship organization. And I just want to make it very clear. So far, everything that we've said or reported on that people have said, no, that can't be true, has come true. And
okay,
this interview, Phyllis, with your information, is going to even more solidify our position that, you know, we weren't assuming this, we weren't making this up, that this stuff is really happening. But for our listeners, please go ahead and start in where you want.
Okay, well, I worked for the Minneapolis Urban League for approximately 1 year, from 06 to 07. And the things I learned in that 1 year eventually led to my termination from the Urban League. One of the main things and concerns that I've always had was the high number of convicted felons working in the Urban League, but particularly sex offenders.
Okay.
How was that
dealt with? Because when you say that you were concerned with it, was it something that you kept private to yourself, or was it something that made you speak to the leadership of the organization, or was it something that was caused by some specific incident or issue that came up?
Yeah, I was unaware of most people's status, as you are in a new job, for the first 6 to 7 months. But then as you get to know people, you realize the backgrounds. And one particular event that came about toward the end of my year there was in the summer of 07, the Minneapolis Youth Step Up Program had a contract with the Urban League to allow so many youth from Minneapolis to attain jobs there for the summer. And one time I was out and found out that my youth had been assigned to a sex offender by the name of Kennedy Barber. And I did write the staff and try to question, and everyone acted like they were unaware. So I didn't get anywhere with my writings, but I did do some letters to Hightower and Sylvia Amos, who was the chief operating officer at that time. I believe that's how you say that. And when I didn't get anywhere, I went ahead and wrote the City of Minneapolis, the Youth Step Up Program.
Okay.
And we had a meeting, but it went nowhere, just went nowhere. They didn't discuss anything about the sex offenders. And shortly thereafter that, I was given a termination letter.
Let me just ask a couple quick questions. So I could, Mr. Allen, just kind of
do the legal
examination here. Phyllis, were you past your probation?
Yes, I was, as far as I knew, past my probation. But, you know, there were...
Well, I asked the question was, so what was the cause? What cause was cited by the administrators of the Urban League, and were you allowed to appeal your termination?
There was no cause cited. It was pretty much a very blank letter saying, you know, you're terminated as of this point. Check into your coverage of this, that, and the other. There was no reason. I was not allowed to appeal, so I took it to the EEOC, which filed also with the Department of Discrimination. But as I found, even the EEOC was incompetent and lost my file for some months, then determined there was no case, then reopened it, and then closed it. And so it almost felt like they all were in cahoots together. Meanwhile, the sex offender was still working there and has had an office there for some years.
Inside the Urban League, right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Was there an incident, I remember some information, was there an incident at a gathering in the summer of 07 in which this individual appeared on the scene and was kind of mingling amongst the youth?
Well, there was an incident in terms of I called the park board and spoke to, I believe, the director's John Olson, because I was highly concerned why Kennedy Barber was in charge and had been for years of the Family Day Parade. I question whose family does he represent when he abused his family. And there, they turned around and kicked him out of the park, North Commons did, and said, this is not going to happen this year. And that was a positive step.
Okay, the park board did. The reason I asked the question, and also Mr. Allen, and I know that even you as my associate and co-host are not aware of this, a year ago I was involved in assisting an African-American employee at the Urban League who was assaulted by a convicted felon, not the individual that we are talking about right now, but an associate in the parking lot of the Urban League there on Plymouth Avenue. And part of it had to do with fraud, but also the attempt at sexual misconduct. And if anyone desires to challenge us, as I'm quite sure no one's going to challenge what Phyllis has said, the complaint is on file with the Manassas Police Department. Basically, what happened in this case that happened in 2009 was that for whatever reason, the authorities kind of covered things up. Scott Gray, the current president of the Urban League, was involved in what was supposed to be in a kind of administrative hearing as it pertains to the assault, which was captured on camera, by the way. The actual physical assault, where actually the individual actually put their hands on the person in the parking lot, was captured on camera. But the Minneapolis assault unit, the Minneapolis Police Department's assault unit declined, I guess, as a part of political consideration and pressure from the mayor's office, as we now understand it, not to take any affirmative, quote-unquote, action in this particular assault. The young lady in question, who comes from a very, very respected family here in the Twin Cities, her late father was very well known, very well respected, was very much involved in the area of affirmative action and things like that. She terminated her it was a combination of initially they terminated her. She attempted to get the administrative hearing, and then an agreement was reached, but she said she could no longer work in the Urban League and feel safe with respect to what had happened and the kind of threat that had been imposed on her. I was not aware of the situation with the caller that we have now, but it makes sense, Phyllis, with respect to a pattern in practice.
Well, if I might say, I think this goes back to, I believe, the start of Hightower's reign, and that he created a culture of sexual misconduct. It was said he had numerous sexual harassment complaints, that many women in particular had been terminated wrongfully because they weren't willing to do sexual favors. And it was also learned that this culture of sexual misconduct breeded these predators because these sex offenders happened to be his close associates outside of the job. Now, when you have an environment where the CEO is hiring all of his friends over African-Americans who have went to school, no criminal records, well-qualified, and had major history of serving the youth in this community, it was very upsetting and hard to understand why the environment was continually going in that direction.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely correct. What bothers me, Phyllis, is the denial of jurisprudence here, of due process, the opportunity for you to contest, if you will, the termination of your employment with the agency, because the thing that the Urban League is supposed to stand for, it doesn't stand for anything else. And I speak from significant experience, is that it stands for justice and equal opportunity and a sense of fair play and the new words we like to use now, transparency. But yours appears to be a story told by many, unfortunately, in the last 7 or 8, 9 years with respect to that organization and its leaderships. And this would tie into the unfortunate incident and the beating of the Reverend Major Topps at Reverend Hightower's church just a couple of weeks ago. as an outgrowth of a dispute that was along the lines of sexual misconduct and relationships that has now permeated the church. And it is extremely troubling because it has been told to me in the last 24 hours that this is the rationale, I would bet that your case is one of them, that the white power corporate community is saying, let's let the Urban League go under.
Mm-hmm. Well, if I might back up just one moment in terms of when you talked about employees going through these things at the Urban League, one of the ways they get away with it is because Minnesota is an at-will state. They can hire you at will. That is no accountability on the part of the employer to explain or be accountable for their behavior. One of the things under that act, it just has an unclear description saying a person that shows a lack of concern for their employment, that could be considered at will. And in my case, because I turned them in to the city of Minneapolis, they wrote me a letter pretty much stating this policy that I showed a lack of concern for my employment by going against them.
Okay.
That was clear to me why I lost all these cases, because in a Minnesota court of law, all of the judges are going to go by the statute. So there it
is.
Well,
you're absolutely, that's an excellent point of law, Phyllis. You're absolutely on point there.
In terms of Major Tops, I did hear recently of his death, and I don't really know what to say. I don't want to be rude, but one thing I did come across was that the school district in 1998 took away funds that they were given to the Urban League, Hightower, for an after-school program, and he assigned that program to Major Tops. The school district reported that their records showed that he had been arrested for possession of marijuana and having an open bottle in the presence of a minor. So why Major Tops, 5-10 years later, still walking around the Urban League was also a confusion to us when we come across this letter that has been documented to the Urban League that this man was inappropriate for children.
Okay. That's very
interesting. Wow. Yes, it is.
Now you also, just reading your CV here, you also had some information that you know about some of the budgets, like Acorn and different things that you felt in your tenure there wasn't right. You want to get into that a little bit, maybe?
Well, sure. One of the disturbing things is that the Urban League had a successful program. I believe it was called Credit Smart, but it went through its variation of names. But a wonderful woman over on the Southside office worked really hard to make that program successful. And that program provided house payments to prevent foreclosure for rent or home to people in our community, African Americans. And so in the year I was there, it was awarded double its amount of money because of its success. And, of course, foreclosure rates were going sky high. And I literally saw the supervisor, we all did, David Oguanema. He literally took the budget, brought it back to the person in charge of the program with half of its money gone. Then he gave her a whole new set of qualifications that would make it virtually impossible for anyone to attain the money. Therefore, I assume by the end of the year, he was able to spend all of the money given to them by GMAC, by the way, without any accountability. And we know in nonprofit, if you don't spend that money by the end of the year, you got to give it back. So, of course, you're going to find a way to spend it. But there's people who are there right now that tells you nobody in our community received any of that money. Nobody got any payments. Nothing. So it's situations like that we watched that was heartbreaking. You know what I mean?
That also makes sense then with respect to the controversy last year, if you remember, when a conservative very right-wing think tank investigative unit unfortunately basically almost brought about the downfall of Acorn. a federal grand jury, as I made to understand, was looking and has been looking at Acorn's operations here in the Twin Cities. And ironically, and what Phyllis has done is given, I know certainly myself, a little bit more specificity and detail to a, what we thought was a rumor that there had been serious mismanagement of foreclosure funds under a variety of programs at the Urban League of Minneapolis, and a federal grand jury was looking at that. And, you know, Mr. Allen, that may be the reason that a number of board members, particularly a couple who are attorneys, have bailed out of board responsibility and have resigned from the board and quietly, you know, went off into the sunset. Because what Phyllis has just shared with us raises real serious questions with respect to a report that was issued by the United Way in examining why it was it removed a significant chunk of money, about $300,000 or so, that in April, and we reported on that on these programs and in our respective media formats. Mr. Scott told the board in April of 2009 that the money was in place. And then you remember, Mr. Allen, and we in fact reported on these very programs, we didn't have the background that has been offered by Phyllis, if you will, but the United Way took sanctions against the Urban League and took back close to $300,000 to almost $400,000. Now that begins to make sense.
Yes.
Because the Urban League was rolling that money over into personal accounts and et cetera. Phyllis, can you give us, because these are the kinds of things that the public needs to know, our community needs to know on why they're not receiving services or that services have in fact collapsed or deteriorated. Is there anything in addition you have on this foreclosure issue?
Well, I thought it was suspect when they developed the partnership with Acorn. I can honestly say to you that I spoke to the director of Acorn at the time, and I don't have her name today, but I sat down with her and explained to her my experience at the Urban League, and that I didn't know why they would put the, their program into another program that has a history of not providing the services that they say they're gonna, and the director didn't really seem to have any concern with any of that. They were happy with their partnership. They called it Sharks. Now, in the real estate world, that's not a very positive title. I'm not sure who was thinking about that. However, what it turned out to be was one more collaborative where people got no money, but they just had counselors take people's files, personal information, and try to help them negotiate. And I like to veer a little and say I'm kind of irritated with all of the foreclosure programs because they seem to all have the same pattern of taking federal dollars or state dollars, not giving any financial assistance out of foreclosure, but a bunch of counseling services. And I have proof that the counselors are really not that trained. Therefore, they are also aiding and abetting in keeping people in the modification process for sometimes 3 years.
Wow.
That's mm-hmm. insane. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I think there needs to be a cleanup of the foreclosure programs and the Urban League, too. I would hate to see it closed, but at the same time, it needs to be start over from scratch because there seems to be no police in this world, no nonprofit police anywhere.
You're absolutely
and I know
on,
that was the board, probably. Yeah,
I
was the board job, but, you know,
I think that we're going to find out, unfortunately, at some point in time, and it'll probably be sooner than later because of the political change here in Minnesota in which the Republicans have moved into seats of power. You know, this also explains why a number of members of the Urban League board became very quietly involved in finance, housing finance, Mr. Allen. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
And this question was raised by an alliance in which both Mr. Allen and myself were involved in the summer of 2009. And basically what happened, the Urban League basically shut down any inquiry. Mr. Brassad, who Mr. Allen mentioned earlier in this broadcast, was asked some questions. He is the director of what is called Director of Affiliates. Ooh. And he did, as the representative of Acorn, did you, Phyllis, indicated that they were comfortable with what was happening. What's troubling also about this is that Mayor R.T. Ryback has in fact touted these kinds of programs and has touted the foreclosure situation and has pronounced that a significant positive kinds of programming and assistance is going on, when any damn fool can see that that's not what's happening, particularly in that African Americans, particularly in North Minneapolis, but also in South Minneapolis. The case of Miss Williams is an example, is the illustration of that, were the first wave of Americans who went under when the whole foreclosure sham fully exposed itself. And people like, you know, Reverend Hightower and a lot of other ecumenical legends and giants who were also involved in OOPS, housing finance and purchases and et cetera, knew this. And now we begin to get a little better understanding on why there's so much silence.
Yeah, and if I could just interject here, Phyllis and Mr. Erwitt, before you go further here. Mr. Erwitt, you said something really interesting about Minneapolis Mayor R.T. Ryback, who is just always touting these programs. This is just like the Broadband Digital Closing the Digital Divide Access Program for Internet. I don't know if maybe Phyllis or you have tried to log in on the city of Minneapolis Internet. You know, they tout this free Wi-Fi. Yeah, it's impossible.
Right.
It's slow. And they've gotten millions of dollars in federal funding to address, you know, this Wi-Fi issue. You know, I should be able to drive into Minneapolis, sit there and pull out my computer in the car and get a signal. But it doesn't happen. Just doesn't happen.
It does not happen.
If I might say, you know, we have some understanding about Ryback after he voted against the foreclosure freeze. I think that was a critical part and a huge message to all of us on behalf of him, and then turned around and allocated all of that money for the Twin Stadium. It was told to us the city of Minneapolis offered Mary Jo almost $80 million to get out of their face.
That's right.
So they tell us that they're broke, but what I heard from the real estate people was that Ryback was putting in bids on these abandoned properties here in Minneapolis, trying to get them for himself or for the city. But because of the process that the city takes to make payment, they were losing out against cash investors. The bank wasn't willing to wait. And then you find that while all of this was going on, the city of Minneapolis now made a regulation that any property that sits vacant, they charge $6,000 a year. So to me, it just looks like they're really cleaning up on this foreclosure process. They're not concerned with it. They're profiting major.
And unfortunately for the African-American community, again, for our domestic and international audiences, this is the reason that there is such a disproportionate number of African-Americans in this city. Because technically, I mean, when we, you know, to hold us against Chicago, Kansas City, St. Louis, Atlanta, Cleveland, et cetera, Detroit, we have a very small black population, but proportionally, the number of African Americans who have been forced out of their homes has been staggering, and there has been a total refusal to examine how this has happened, because every time that it comes up for discussion, the great white liberal mayor, R.T. Ryback, is positioned as indicating that everything is well on the plantation.
And, you know, Mr. Everson, if we could just Phyllis, if we could just go back to fourth quarter 2007 when this thing started heating up with the foreclosures, especially in one of the most devastated areas in the country, North Minneapolis, okay, when there were like 700 homes, I think, about 700
homes
in foreclosure. Okay, and if you look at the money that came down from the federal government, so if you go from 2007 to January 2009, you're looking at about $100 million there. And that's very conservative amount. And so $100 million, and I have to go back and look at these websites and backtrack sometimes, because I don't see how that $100 million helped any one of those homeowners. What they did was they hired their friends, they hired people from banks, that were given the bad loans and loan companies to come in and counsel folks that were losing their homes. So rather than take that, okay, North Minneapolis, 700 homes in foreclosure, okay? You're talking about an amount between $15,000 behind and $20,000 behind. Okay,
which goes to Phyllis's statement about personnel who really were able to do nothing more than just try to counsel people, and half the time they unfortunately didn't understand the complexity of the foreclosure proposition. That makes a lot of sense.
Exactly. And so with that said, those two amounts between $15,000 and $20,000, we're just going to roll with $15,000 right now. And then we're going to throw in gas back, say, 6 months' worth of gas bills, and we're going to put them in 3 months of prepaid gas bills ahead, okay? Then we're putting electric in, and we're going to put a couple other things in. So now we're up to $20,000, okay? So you have 700 folks, and I don't have my calculator open right now, and you gave each one of them folks $25,000, okay? Over the with the $100 million that the city of Minneapolis received, actually it was more than that, they could have squashed the foreclosure problem here in North Minneapolis. But what they
right now hold your point, Mr. Allen, because I'm certainly very appreciative of Phyllis, who is giving us a level of depth that confirms what we already know. I'm going to take you back to week 9, if I'm not mistaken. I don't have my computer operating on that particular program, but take you back to week 9 on this program. Remember when we had a white financial expert that took the time to call in, because remember we were talking about Franklin National Bank? And he laid out exactly what Phyllis has just laid out to us with respect to what was happening in the city of Minneapolis, what was happening to the foreclosures, and one of the reasons, by the way, that Franklin National Bank is in trouble. And I find that to be almost deja vu. And, Phyllis, I have to say that to you, that that's almost deja vu to have heard you make the statement that you made just a couple of moments ago. And I think back to, I'm pretty sure, Don, it was week 9 of On Point. And this individual called in. Remember, we had a very, very long, in-depth discussion.
Yes.
And he was talking about, And go right ahead, Phyllis. I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, I want to say on this point, again, I'm maybe a conspiracy theorist, but I go back to the 90s when the flips were going on. And if you look at real estate in Minnesota, you hardly were getting any convictions for real estate fraud. You had one maybe major black realtor who got convicted,
Maxwell.
But there were many... Yes, you know, there are many corporations like Coldwell Banker Burnett, Edina, Remax that contributed and fostered the predatory acts, but I blame the state because they were lax at commerce with their real estate laws on these brokers. Then where Minneapolis comes in with a twist is that Minneapolis has no resources to help a owner with their water bill. But that's the one utility that can get your property closed, condemned, and taken from the city. Why is
Absolutely.
That?
Mm-hmm.
There's
Absolutely.
There's a coordination for me there. And as a single mother, I have searched high and low, and I promise I can tell you no one helps with water bills. They'll let you get turned off, condemned, and they'll come see you. That
right.
Even right there in itself to me is predatory.
Well, what you've also done is exposed a dirty little secret now, and this is not the appropriate place in the context of time and et cetera, but yours truly can well remember when discussions came up with respect to that as a particular issue because of the mandatory requirements of sanitation and livable habitat and et cetera. And people couldn't figure out what you just said was absolutely on point, why there was no provision. There is no provision in the city of Minneapolis to deal with a situation or to provide any assistance when your water gets cut off.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Don, if you remember, we had an activist here. You and I both know we will not mention their name, who became a celebrity, if you will, 2 years ago when their water was cut off at their home in South Minneapolis.
Yeah, yeah.
People listening to him and his attorney found out just how arbitrary and capricious the city can be when your water's cut off with respect to the issues of sanitation and et cetera. And, Phyllis, again, I have to give you kudos That's a very interesting observation that you have made, and you have developed a understanding as you make that, because people are not aware. Now, the reason I'm able to say that is that I am, in the other life, if you will, I am a former utilities executive, and I know the kind of philosophy and discussions that used to take place when I worked for Northern States Power Company for 21 and a half years. You know, you're the first person in a long time that I've heard who peaked that, if you will, the whole issue of what happens when they cut your water off. Very interesting. Yeah. Mr.
And,
Allen?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Phyllis.
Well, no, I just think it speaks loudly to the situation that we're in with the foreclosures. But if we go back and look at where you talked about where the money went, I can also testify about being a client in one of these programs, because after I lost my job, I needed help with my home, and I was determined not to lose it. And I went to NERC, whom I know. I
okay.
know that they offered financial assistance at one point, up to the tune to $10,000. You had to go through a lot of steps, and there was a lot of requirements, but that was there, like the Urban League. Same with Habitat for Humanity. There was a point in the beginning they offered financial assistance, but quietly, very quietly, they've shifted their programs to not do that. We know NERC is closed now, and we know they were exposed, but you got Habitat, you got Northside Neighborhood Housing. They've all quietly dismantled that giving out money because they know they've spent it, they've used it on other purposes. No one is holding them accountable. And I would like to see some accountability, because you're right, when you do the math, none of us should be struggling. But I'm going to tell you one more game they throw out there. Last year, Hennepin County got a huge amount of money also. They're just as guilty. They got money to help people in emergency assistance with payments. But you know what they did? They turned around and said, you know what, we're not going to help anybody in modification. Again, there are people out here in modification for 3-4 years. That cuts out a nice chunk of people trying to hang on to their home.
Phyllis, could you do this for the purpose of transparency? Could you indicate to our listening audience what does modification mean statutorily?
Okay, modification is one of the options that a homeowner has to keep their home by having the mortgage company look at your situation, your finances, how you got into the trouble you got into, and lowering the payments to a more affordable level for where you are at the time, whether unemployed, in college, working part-time. They adjust that so you can maintain and hold on. It's almost like a refinance, if you will, without you going through the money down and all of that. It's an in-house process. And a good foreclosure prevention counselor is skilled at walking through all of the options, because that's just one option a homeowner has. But a good counselor will tell you that there are about 4 or 5 options that mortgage companies will use, but it's their goal not to use them.
Correct, correct. And in fact, we have a sitting federal judge who has been given the broad universal authority and has been looking at these foreclosures. And I saw a piece with him about 3 months ago, Mr. Allen, and he's been the walker of doom for many of the institutions. And he said exactly the same thing, laid it out like that, and talked in terms of his disgust as a sitting administrator, if you will, but who is a federal judge, that this is one of the things that the finance institutions went overboard with to make sure that they did not walk you through the proper steps that would maybe have allowed you to have been salvaged and saved. That's fascinating that we're getting that kind of discussion. But I again take you back to the gentleman that called us. I'm pretty sure, Mr. Allen, it was week 9, and laid out in a similar manner what was happening. And, the first thing Quote wanted to say was that guy didn't know what he was talking about, just like they'll tell us that Phyllis doesn't know what she's talking about, et cetera. But Mr. Allen has sitting in front of him at his computer, as I look, the figures, which were supposed to be an issue of contention during the last mayoral election last year, But unfortunately, we didn't have any candidates who had the ability to know how to articulate that.
Yeah.
All right, Phyllis, anything else you'd like to share with us? We certainly appreciate you taking this time. You're one of the longest guests that we've had, but this has been an enlightenment to me.
That's going to be a half hour or so.
I just appreciate it, and I'm always willing to do another part two if you need be. I just am happy to express these things that we have been feeling and knowing. It's been going on, not knowing why, not knowing what to do. And some people have been reporting, have been telling, and nothing's happening. So then you feel very oppressed at that point. So I thank you for doing the show. All right.
Thank you, Phyllis. We appreciate you calling
in. Thank you very much.
Mr. Allen knows how to contact you, and I think maybe in a couple of weeks we need to have you back.
Yes. All right, great. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
All right,
bye-bye.
Have a great
bye-bye.
Night. Yes.
Bye-bye. You know, Don... I'm not sure, and we have not asked, and if we did, we wouldn't indicate it publicly. You know, Phyllis is the kind of person that we should have in an elected position, like city council or state representative, maybe even United States congressman. You know what I'm saying? With respect to the depth of information, knowledge, and compassion, and feeling for right over wrong, if you will, and her people. See, that's the kind of person you're looking for to run for political office.
Exactly. And she knows what she's talking about. She's been there. She's been through it. So, I would love, if I could find out, exactly. It'd be great if she lived over north to run out after Don Samuels there. I think that would be really great.
One of the names that I was thinking about, particularly in light of Alderman Samuels' silence about the disproportionate number of foreclosures, in the what is called the lower north end of the north side. He's been extremely silent. Though, as you reported, IBNN, he's made some nice profit off some of these programs.
Oh, yes.
The properties that he controls.
Well, between the POLAD Foundation giving him forgivable grants and we just mentioned it, Franklin Bank.
Yes, Franklin National Bank. Uh-huh.
Looking out for him. Yeah, he's done pretty well. I mean, he's done better than the average citizen in North Minneapolis as far as obtaining, funds. But then again, there's some things behind that we'll have to get to eventually on why, and we will get there. So you can run, but you can't hide. So.
All right. Let me just say that the information provided over the last, actually, 40-some minutes, almost 50 minutes, by the caller, really raises some disturbing questions about a organization, that being the Urban League, who should have been facilitating in the best interest and for the protection and in the ecumenical spirit for the salvation of the black community, and has did anything but under some current and past leadership, if you will. But it explains the conspiracy of silence that has become the hallmark of so many of the leaders. And I wanted to take this occasion to talk in terms of the firestorm, Mr. Allen, that has been created by NAACP President Booker T. Hodges, his article in this week's edition of the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder.
Yeah.
They are upset with Mr. Hodges, and I'm aware that one of our ministers, a former professional athlete, called the Star Tribune, called the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, and just attempted to blast the assistant editor there, Mr. Jerry Freeman. Apparently that's not going to work this time. They've been doing that quite a bit, but they, the African-American leadership group, the African-American Black Ministerial Alliance, and et cetera, are livid because of the statements made. And also the publisher of the newspaper that is identified as serving the African-American community, whose publisher is also, a board member of the Minneapolis Urban League, are livid because of the statements and reflection Mr. Hodges made, particularly with respect to the conspiracy that has been entered into by many of them with Superintendent Johnson to basically hand over the education, the miseducation of African-American children to these charter school hustlers and pimps.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And, you know, I read that story, and with permission from the publisher of the Spokesman Recorder, I was able to republish that on IBNN News. And the president of the NAACP here, Mr. Booker Hodges, goes into some detail on what's actually happening, what's going on, and how these people are drafting this information like they represent education in Minnesota or Minneapolis at this point.
Yeah, and, absolutely, and correct.
Again,
yeah.
the full press hustle is on. And, you know, I mean,
I had
someone come to me the other day and just say, you know, why you write what you do, you know, because, you know, a lot of people don't want to work with you. I said, these are the same people that are going around pimping the community, and they'll get hundreds of thousands of dollars, and nothing will get done. I said, I don't need to be a part of that plan.
Well, let me say that on this particular piece. Early this morning, and they have been for weeks, you know, the so-called internal group put together by Gary Cunningham and the Northwest Area Foundation for the continued dismantling of whatever's left of the African American community, you know, they've been meeting at UROC.
Oh no! Oh wow!
Yeah,
on Saturday.
They've been meeting there on Saturday mornings for about 2 hours. They have coffee, donuts, and talk about the black community like they have tales. These are black folk, I mean, you know, but they have been positioned and selected by the white power structure. And they've been meeting over at UROC on Saturday mornings. And this morning, a surveillance team went in, took a look at what was happening. And it wasn't many of them there this morning. A lot of them couldn't get, you know, out from their suburban homes because of the snowstorm, right? But there was a small delegation in gathering, because that's where the letter, by the way, Mr. Allen, was developed that has caught so many people off guard. That was the letter in which our leadership, black leadership, double-crossed the black masses by calling for the closing of North High School. Remember that?
Yes, yes.
What happened was is that a couple of people who thought that they were in like Flynn were in the meetings, and the information and suggestions were being made by William English, who's a part of that group. Jeffrey Garcon, the attorney, is the so-called chairman of the Education Committee. And this particular person, who thought that, you know, they understood what was going on, was shocked when the discussion began in those meetings at UROC to undermine and undercut the African-American community by sending a formal letter, which was on the front page of the paper called Insight, as if they got some kind of exclusivity, indicating the North High School needed to be closed. Now, here's what's troubling. Some of the people that signed the letter, Mr. Allen, are on the payroll of the school district.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Mr. English, Mr. Hassan, I mean, I'm not understanding what is happening here to the extent of the acceptability of this kind of conduct.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense, because, you know, I'm just going to back up for a little bit, Mr. Edwards, on that, because
go right ahead.
When North High first was scheduled or suggested to be closed by Superintendent Bernadette Johnson, you know, there was a huge outroar in the community. People had hoped that black men in the community like Bill English, Al McFarland, Randy Statton, Reverend Jerry McAfee, and others would support, you know, keeping their beloved historical high school open. When all along in the background, these guys are working directly. I mean, I know for a fact that these point people, these North High, same North High groups, have talked to Mr. McFarland, have talked to Mr. Statton, have talked to Mr. English, have talked to Reverend McAfee. And what they said to them is not what was reflected in that letter, you know, that they wrote talking about they're in support of closing North High. And it's really ridiculous of the double talk that's going on from these people, because, you know, now if something really bad happens in the black community, these folks certainly can't be trusted.
Absolutely. For our international and domestic audience, could you just kind of detail a tad, Mr. Allen, some of the content of this letter, which was developed by this so-called education group under the chairmanship of Jeffrey Hassan, at UROC that indicated that there was this broad support for the closing of North High School. Could you just give us some specific details?
Yeah, I am actually going there right now. I have it on file here, and I wanted you to I'm just going to have to look it up here real quick. But in the meantime, while I'm looking at it, I'm also seeing in the details of the letter here, just let me pull it up here real quick. I'm in the studio right here across from you and working double computers here, so just give me a second here to pull this up.
Right. And I'll do while we look to retrieve it, just indicate how emotional here in Minneapolis the closing of this high school, which is a 100-and-some-year-old facility, which has been the heart and soul of the what we call the far north, middle north of Minneapolis, the dismantling, the rape of this high school and its position within the African community politically has been extremely troubling. The gentlemen that Mr. Allen and I are talking about have been people that I remember 5 years ago, Mr. English and Stanton made the declaration that they and they solely speak for the educational future of the African American in the entire educational district. And I remember telling people that was probably a mistake. But folks, let them go to the school board meetings, take positions, undermine the best interests of the African-American community, if you will, cut out the ground from under those that were involved in attempting to advance the best possible conditions for the education of the African-American. And I know there's been some discussion, by the way, Mr. Allen, and we are not at liberty to go into great detail, Mr. Allen or myself, but I know that some of the professional educators have become extremely upset and distraught with the kind of shenanigans that's going on, and particularly this letter that was published in the paper known as Insight, in which these characters, if you will, talked in terms that there was tremendous support for the closing of North High School. Now, yet they have never came or showed up at a public forum and spoke to sometimes crowds as large as 400 that have gathered over the last three months to dispute, debate, and oppose the closing of North. These individuals are the kind of silent, faceless assassins that do egregious harm to the future of the African American. But it was this letter, because what happened was we understand that they were told that given the amount of money that they received from the school district, that there were some expectations. And Superintendent Bernadette Johnson is legendary with respect to the kinds of demands she can put on you in exchange for proving to her that you're a loyal subject.
Interesting. Okay, I'm here. You know, it's really funny because this was this statement or this news article in the Insight was originally titled Community Leaders Applaud North High's new vision.
And right.
Now the title is Elders Applaud New North High Vision. And this is Randy Stanton, Bill English, Jerry McAfee, and Mr. Hassan there. It says, we unequivocally support Superintendent Johnson's initial decision to close North High School, North High Community School. And we applaud her current efforts to work with the Northside community in establishing a new North. The actual letter is not in here, and there's not a link to it, but the story can be found at Insight News, and you click on Education. There are no RSS feeds or anything like that to send out, but it is here. So
right. And we are aware, though we will be gracious and not indicate the person who was in some of the meetings at UROC and who became shocked when they realized how they had been played. In fact, at one point in one of the meetings, when this particular Northside resident, graduate of North High School, attempted to contest Mr. English about what they were doing, she was told to shut up and sit down, if you will. And there has been a lot of patting on the back, if you will, of this group, which is now sponsored by the Headwaters Foundation, which in turn is being funded by the Northwest Area Foundation, if I'm not mistaken. to carry out this, what is called the Changing Face of the African American Community Project, which we wrote about it in our columns a year ago in the Spokesman Recorder. They can be recaptured by going to the website, or specifically going to one of our websites, www, the Minneapolis Story. Go back to April, May, June of 2009, where we wrote about this plan. In fact, the master plan was actually put together in Pocatello, Idaho.
And Mr. Edwards.
Go right ahead.
We have a little bit of technical difficulty there, but I have you back here. Like I said, the article up there in Insight News is under education. You can read it. And I don't see attachment for the original draft letter, but we can keep looking for that here. And that's what I'm doing in the other studio actually
okay.
right now.
Well, let me do this, though. Let me go back to the origin of this group that has been meeting in UROC. This group was formulated in Pocatello, Idaho, last year in April of 2009 at a retreat of the Northwest Area Foundation. And later on that same week, a meeting was called at the at a so-called organization, Stair Step Foundation.
Yes.
And a representative of the Northwest Area Foundation presented what was purportedly the master plan for the reorganization of the African American community's leadership, endorsed by Mayor R.T. Ryback. And in fact, in that meeting, a couple of ministers who were shocked that the changing the face included their removal and walked out of the meeting cursing out, really, ministers, cursing out the Northwest Area Foundation. But the doctrine, which has led, as an example, to the letter supporting the closing of North High School, actually came about as an outgrowth of a retreat by the Northwest Area Foundation in Pocatello, Idaho, where they had gathered for their annual administrative meeting. And I can well remember in the early part, and also just as Mr. Gray was arriving as the new head of the Minneapolis Urban League, the discussions that you and I were hearing about the fact that there was going to be a new day, a new order, with respect to the direction of the African-American community and the issues that the African-American community would be allowed to raise. And so it's very interesting to see what appears to be somewhat of a reversal, because Mr. Scott has not been with us, of the Urban League, has not been with us for 2 years yet. I mean, you know, normally you get a chance to come in for 2 years and then, you know, you kind of post up, if you will, like a basketball game and kind of get your skills and talents recognized and maybe see if you're draft material. You know what
yeah,
I'm saying?
Definitely.
But folks can't, not able to hang on. You know, we've got about, 15, 16 minutes. Could we just give the number again, Mr. Allen? I'm interested to see if there's some callers maybe want to call in. And
yeah, we invite callers to call in. You can talk about anything, you know, or be on topic. The number is toll-free. It's 1-877-572-4288. Again, that number is 877-572-4288. And also, Mr. Edwards, you can't forget the Miss Black Minnesota USA pageant and scholarship event is tonight at Ted Mann Concert Hall over on the University of Minnesota campus. Tickets available right now.
Yes, yes, yes. An excellent job has been done by the organizers who have been able to revive the Miss Black Minnesota, which at one point was a very important piece of the African-American community. Kind of fell on hard times. The organizers have come back with a vigor, if you will, and so I was so happy to hear that they have put it together, and it will be happening at the, as you just reported, the Ted Mann Conference. Also want to take this opportunity to remind our local listeners, and we'll be talking about it clearly next Saturday, the most infamous disparity study will be voted on by the council, though there has been a group that both Mr. Allen and myself have been involved in that earlier in the week asked the Minneapolis City Council and the city government to hold up our confirmation, if you will, and endorsement of the whatever the plan is that Velma Corvell is coming in with. But my understanding is, Mr. Allen, as of yesterday, that we have been basically told that there will be no response. And so on Thursday the 9th, Velma Corvell, the executive director of the Civil Rights Department, will make a formal presentation in which basically she will ignore many of the finite points that were presented in the disparity report, make some series of recommendations to put in play some of the white contractors that you talked about that were at the closed meeting this morning with the Assistant Secretary for Enforcement and Civil Rights of the Department of Transportation. And then on Friday, the 10th of December, in a day that will forever live in infamy, the Minneapolis City Council will confirm the recommendations, and the continued economic dismantling of the African-American community will continue. So as they used to say on that old program, happy days are here again.
Yeah. Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
And that again, go ahead.
No, I was just going to tell you on that. You know, I did send Councilwoman Elizabeth Glidden an email. She did answer me back saying that she would contact me, but year to date, it hasn't happened.
Let me just say on that point, again, for transparency, I talked to Councilmember Glidden on November the 4th and the 5th of November. That was over a month ago. You and I both were present in the council when the disparities study was made officially public, by the way. Again, for our listening audience, the taxpayers of the city of Minneapolis, which includes black folk, paid a little over $500,000 for this study. And we were present. I talked with Glidden personally and then with her office and asked for the opportunity to be afforded to the African-American community and other communities of color for our discussion, meaningful discussion, on the diversity study and the revelations, and she promised that she would have a public hearing under her authority as a council member and as chairwoman of the committee that the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department reports to. She lied. She lied about that. At some point in time, I have to indicate to you that I was informed by a very high-ranking member of the city council that the decision had been made there would be no public hearing. Now, allegedly, there are these public comments which are being sanitized by Velma Corvell and the Civil Rights Department that are coming in, and it'll be interesting to see just how many of these public comments she puts into play on Thursday morning, because on Thursday morning at 9 o'clock, the council will meet as the Committee of the Whole. And the word, by the way, Mr. Allen, and we'll see some of these individuals in about an hour when we go to the function. Mm-hmm. Some of these individuals, powerful white contractors and et cetera, are rubbing their hands together because they're looking at how much more money will be coming their way and how much money will not be going to the African-American community. It is a sad day.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I look forward to looking them in their eyes again. That's the whole thing seems to be set up from the beginning because, you know, the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights, well, just put it like this, we don't have a Minneapolis a functioning civil rights department at all whatsoever. And it's very interesting that they let these people be in control of some very important issues. I mean, you have a guy down there now, Michael Crip Brown, who is the investigative unit director, who was chased out of there a few years back, and the file was sealed. And I just want to let folks know that are listening, got a lot of people tuned in here, is that, you know, in about 3 days, we'll be broadcasting live interviews with what we call one of the victims of Mr. Michael Kip Brown in the Minneapolis Department of Civil Rights when he was the acting director down there. So you can go back and tell him that.
Very good. Just as we have been able to have an exclusive interview with a person who has really detailed to us some of the corruption and skullduggery that has gone on inside of the Minneapolis Urban League, sexual misconduct, pedophiles, and et cetera, as well as significant fraud of monies that had allegedly been set aside to help fight the foreclosure issues. These are the kind of things I wonder if the African-American leadership group that we've heard so much about for the last 10 years, do you think they'll have this on their agenda. Do they still meet, by the way, Mr. Allen? Or do you?
I haven't heard anything about them. I don't really don't, Mr. Harris. Honestly, I don't think they give a hoot. I mean, I.
Oh, you know, I was being facetious.
Yeah,
I was being facetious, yeah, because you're absolutely right. I know they don't care. I mean, I know they have no concern whatsoever for the well-being, for the safety of the African-American community. Theirs is one of how much money can they get, how many folks can they rip off, and how much damage can they do to the moral fiber of the community, as expressed by the caller, Phyllis, earlier in this program. So now we're in fairly bad shape up here.
Yeah. It's the Arizona of the North, basically. So
Yes.
And you know what, if we had a big, I was talking to a young man about this yesterday at the Hubert H. Humphrey Institute over on the University of Minnesota campus. I mean, if we had a core of black men that were supported to make changes and you know, people would react, I think that we'd do a lot better. But now, as one of the wise elders told me, it says, once money and sex is to the table, all bets are off. You know, and
what was that again? Repeat that again. Money and what?
Money and sex. Once money
oh,
and
okay.
sex is table,
okay.
Everyone's pants are down, looking like Bobby socks around their ankles. So, it's a rough haul here, but you have to. And I say that jokingly, but it's a serious issue when you know you have a huge facility to fund somebody in the tune of $200,000, and this guy hasn't done anything for this other facility for 2 years, and then they're wondering what happened to the money. You know, well, what do we give them this money for in the first place? You know, and
right,
we have these,
right.
You know, the community here in Minneapolis or in Twin Cities in whole has lost millions. I mean, you're talking about $70-90 million this year alone coming into the Twin Cities, and especially in North Minneapolis. And what? Nothing changed. Broadway still looks the same. I see no businesses. I don't see no entrepreneur programs. I mean, I see zero. So, I mean, what happens? I mean, lucky, fortunately for me, I'm a businessman and I can hold my own. But, you know, what if there are those out there that don't have the wherewithal to, that might need to go get a small microloan, that might need some accounting advice, you know, where do they turn to? So,
well, it's an excellent point, but, you know, I can tell you as a veteran of many, many conflicts and wars and et cetera, there will not be a public discussion. Now, we understand that one of the black radio talk show hosts, Lisa Jones, is indicating the attempt to put together a kind of a black consciousness movement. I was hearing that as regards to her. She airs on a radio station here in Minneapolis. And, of course, you wish folks the best of luck with respect to that. But, you know, I saw that way back in the 60s in this town, and I watched it with chagrin, if you will, and sadness as the federal watchdogs back in those days, that was J. Edgar Hoover, just basically dismantled the black movement and the black consciousness, if you will. But what you're saying is still on point. It's needed. One would hope that it would happen when you talk in terms of the level of disparity, poverty that is affecting this community, unemployment, if you will, underemployment. As we reported exclusively here on Point a couple weeks ago after the disparity study came out, that and not a single elected public official, black or white, has expressed any concern about this. That in this city we have a policy, we have an ongoing policy that it is all right to employ for the same job, same qualifications, same everything, a person of color for almost 40% less than we would pay a white person.
Yes, exactly.
And that's akin to the old company store doctrine, if you will, used in the South that allowed folks to take away black folks' land and properties and et cetera. And I've just been fascinated by the silence here, Mr. Allen, in our community, because when you start telling folks that the documentation is there, that African Americans are basically being told here in Minneapolis, because the study concentrated on Minneapolis, that you will have to work for 40% less, if not more, and with the Tea Party and others coming into power, and with Ron Paul out of Kentucky now talking terms that there needs to be a repeal of the Civil Rights statutes of America, we better wake up.
Yep, I agree.
We better wake up.
Yep, and I don't know, here locally, Mr. Evans, I had this idea that maybe we could go talk to the Republicans who got in over at the House and have them straighten out some stuff over here in North Minneapolis. At least that even the thought of that might put the fear in some of them where they would act right a little bit. What do you think?
I concur. I think that there needs to be an approach made to the Republican leadership to ask them to consider a series of public hearings. See, you have just today's program, at least on 20 occasions, I've been keeping tabs here on the computer, you have talked in terms of the amount of dollars that have come into North Minneapolis that allegedly have been directed specifically towards African Americans, people of color. And we need to ask the Republicans to conduct a formal, not an informal, but a formal process, that being public hearings under oath, to have some of these folk come in before all of them get out of town or disappear or whatever it is, and explain where in the heck the money went.
Exactly.
And what has the taxpayers, which I had said earlier in this program, includes African Americans, what have the taxpayers got for their buck, if you will? I'd certainly like to see that happen, and I think that should be something that will be a part of a effort when the legislature convenes in early January. I just think that that it's owed to the communities of color, and it's owed to the so-called legacy of liberalism and so-called justice, and in the name of Humphrey and McCarthy, but particularly on the black side, the beloved Nellie Stone Johnson, Cecil Newman, Redruff, Father Denzel Carty, and others who were in the forefront for 50, 60, 70 years ago to provide opportunity and social justice for the Negro, quote unquote. Because I repeat myself, we are in big trouble here. I mean, and the things that are happening, the everything from incarcerations to the violation of the rights of the Negro in these enclaves, I don't know what, you know, again, in closing for our international and national audience, I don't know what you're being led to believe as it pertains to the propaganda, but we are in a terrible situation. It is beyond misery, if you will. It is as close to genocide as one could possibly come.
Yeah, right here. We have a little bit under 3 minutes left, Mr. Edwards, and I would like to first off thank our caller, Phyllis, calling in earlier, and she, you know, brung me up, enlightened me on a whole lot of stuff, and we will have to have her back here in a couple of weeks, and we always ask that, I mean, don't be afraid to pick up the phone, give us a call, have a conversation, because it's important that we start a conversation, and I think here is a good place to start a conversation, because we can get it out there and let people know, you know, what's on your mind, what's happening, and get some truth and out there. Also, tomorrow, if you live in Minneapolis, in the city of Minneapolis, you can tune in to Channel 17, or you have Comcast Cable. That's Minneapolis Television Network, and see Mr. Ron Edwards, his show Black Focus. We'll be on at 5 p.m. tomorrow. That's Sunday afternoon. It might be snowing anyway. So
that's right. Mr. Allen, if I could just cut in on that and indicate that on our program tomorrow on the Minneapolis Television Network, we'll be talking about WikiLeaks, which has become a significant controversial piece across the planet. We'll be talking about some of the materials, and particularly some communication cables going back to 1966, 67, and 68, which talk in terms of something that was going on in Vietnam with members, black members of the United States Armed Forces. Very, very interesting set of cables in which there's a lot of discussion going on now that that hopefully on the part of conservative types that these memos do not become public. But we understand because of the action that WikiLeaks has taken based on the hackers and et cetera coming in on top of them, that they have put in a special key, and that if anything is to happen to that link, they will release, I guess, hundreds and hundreds of thousands. They've already released around 255,000 communiques and et cetera, which has become a real embarrassment, if you will. But we talk on tomorrow about a series of cables that dealt with undermining American military forces in Vietnam in 1966, 67, and 68.
Wow. Okay. Well, you guys tune in. And remember, we'll be back here next week at 4 p.m. Central Standard Time for On Point. Thanks for listening. And remember, read the Independent Business News Network. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.